Welcome to the AusPNG Network Leadership Series, a Lowy Institute podcast where we talk to emerging and established community leaders around about Papua New Guinea's pressing issues. My name is Mihai Sora, Project Director of the AusPNG Network, and I'm very excited to welcome my guest today, Alan Kadea, here to talk to us about music in Papua New Guinea. G'day, Alan.
Thank you for having me, Mihai, on your podcast. I'm looking forward to it.
Absolute pleasure. Alan Kadea is also known by his stage name AK-47. He is a DJ, artist, producer, record label owner, music judge, creative in the advertising realm, crypto enthusiast, and emerging leader. With over 20 years' experience in the music industry, Alan has helped set up the Central Music Association in Papua New Guinea as the interim president and is about to launch a new music streaming service in Papua New Guinea. Alan, I'm sure our listeners would love to hear more about your personal journey. Can you tell us how you got into the music business?
Sure. My family has a bit of a history with music, and it all sort of started, with my grandparents, but I guess the person who was probably the most gifted thus far was my father was a fantastic lead guitarist. And back in the 60s, he played for a band called Yarrawarri Drifters in his younger years. And he picked up the guitar. He was taught the guitar by his older brother, my uncle Killer. And they used to have a rock and roll band. So I grew up playing a lot of rock and roll music, and mainly the rhythm section, because my father used to always carry the lead. And I think at a really young age, I'm talking like maybe 8, 9, 10 years of age, I actually learned what the rhythm section to most of a standard rock and roll track was. And that's when my interest started. I'm not as good a guitarist as my father, and I think that sort of led to my interest in picking up the piano. When I looked at the piano, I understood it quite quickly compared to the guitar. And so that allowed me to sort of teach myself sort of like multiple instruments at a young age. And that's sort of how my interest in music started at a very young age.
So music is very much a part of your family and your family history. Is that why you're so passionate about music?
Well, I'm a believer in God-given talent. So I believe everybody has a talent, and everybody has something to offer the world. And sometimes it takes a little bit longer for people to find their talents. In some cases, people find them quite early on. And in my case, I was lucky or blessed enough to find that passion and love for music. But I was also it was natural. It came natural to me as well, which is, a talent that I can be thankful for.
And what are some of the themes that you explore with your own music?
Well, one of the challenges, unfortunately for me, was that my father was a musician sort of like recreationally, and when he finally had my older brother, he was quite young. My parents were about 18 or 19 when they had my older brother, and his parents told him that he's got to get a real job and stop this music business once my older brother was born. So they never actually They never took music seriously. They always thought it was just something that you do recreationally for fun. So when I sort of began to talk a lot about music and maybe doing music professionally, they didn't encourage that. And they thought that music wasn't something that you could do as a career in Papua New Guinea. And they sort of encouraged me to go to university, go to school, get into uni and get a formal qualification. There was a lot of doubt, in my early days. And I think because there was a lot of doubt as to whether or not to do it professionally, I just sort of followed things that I was naturally interested in. So at a young age, I was interested in computer games, electronics, And around that time, Yamaha was releasing the PSR keyboard range, which basically came with, I don't know if you've ever seen these keyboards where they have like a button for the drum section, a button for the guitar section, a button for the bass guitar, and so on and so forth. And those were sort of beginning to be released when I was in high school. And I just found that intriguing that you could switch on and off different sections of a song in different genres. So I began to experiment with electronic music at quite an early age as well.
And so there's an element there of overcoming this doubt, this sense that a career in music isn't possible in Papua New Guinea. But there's also, it sounds like there's a playfulness to your music, a sense of exploration and incorporating technology into how you produce music and the sounds that you make. And I'd love to return to that later on in the discussion. Zooming out a bit now, can you walk us through the development of the music industry in Papua New Guinea over the years and tell us a little bit more about the landscape as it is today?
Yeah, I believe our industry has come a long way. And we, for a while, we were caught in what you might call a bubble, especially around the 90s through to the 2000s, in the, I guess, what you could call the cassette and CD era. And so we went from vinyl to cassette and we sort of got stuck in that cassette era in PNG for quite a long time. And I think a lot of it had to do with the record labels, because they were manufacturing and releasing music, like they were recording, releasing, and duplicating in cassette and CD. By the time we made it through to when the MP3 era started, like around, 2008, 2009, what I found is we were still in that cassette era. And I think the record labels thought that music was selling and there was no need to change, the status quo. So we sort of stuck to this one beat, one bassline sort of rhythm. And it was very popular, locals loved it, and there was no real need to change. And while that was happening, the world at large was sort of, surging ahead with different types of, genres, and pop music was evolving, and even world music was evolving as well. And I think PNG just got stuck in this bubble right up until, 2010. So when I entered into the music industry around 2005, there were already some artists doing hip hop, but hip hop was a very, very much a subcategory, was very niche, very small. And it was almost like frowned upon a little bit in PNG, where you sort of looked at as, you're trying to be American, or you're trying to be something that's not Papua New Guinean, and you're trying to be hip-hop and all this sort of stuff. And so it was almost anti-establishment. But, that's really what hip-hop is. Hip-hop is just, you're expressing yourself and speaking your mind and what you stand for. I think a lot of my career and my timing, as well as what was happening in the industry, was always going against the grain. And that was sort of like very reminiscent of those 90s to 2000 era, where technology was here, but it wasn't being widely used yet in the local music industry.
So you've touched there on themes of a technological barrier or an industry convention that separated the PNG music landscape from the rest of the world. And you've also referred to this struggle for self-validation for young artists in choosing the forms that they have to express themselves, this sort of concern there about the legitimacy of the modes that they've chosen. Overall, what would you say are the main obstacles for young PNG artists today?
I think today, and it's always been an issue, is how do we export our music, our local music, to an international audience, or at least an audience, you know, abroad, outside of the PNG market itself. And I think there is one thing that I've learned is that, you know, the diaspora of PNG music is basically like, you know, it's Papua New Guineans living abroad, namely here in Australia, you know, in the Pacific Islands, and even abroad in like places like territories like Europe. So Papua New Guineans love PNG music. I think newer categories like island music, island reggae, is starting to really take off. And that's been sort of taken off, I would say, like in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, that's really hit its mark. In places like the US with Polynesian artists like Jay Boog, you know, and others making it quite big in the US, with like very island reggae type vibes. And then obviously you have like another part of the island reggae scene, which is the original, you know, Jamaica, which is on the other side of the world. But our music is very similar to, you know, reggae in South Africa. Lucky Dube was a very big artist in PNG. And so I think we've got two sort of main markets that, you know, of music that we love, and trying to find those where those markets sit internationally is our local music, as in local, traditional, sort of tribal, moving into world music, and also our island reggae vibe as well.
So is that where you would see the greatest potential to develop the PNG music industry? That's sort of connecting the local, more traditional sounds with that international island reggae movement that's quite popular today?
I believe so. I believe there are two different categories. One is quite suited to a very local market, and then which is the sort of that traditional local, what you would call like traditional contemporary. And then the second one, the island reggae vibe, I think that's more the newer generation are definitely sort of moving into that realm as well, of like, you know, and if you notice, Polynesians, Melanesians, like Micronesians, a lot of us here in the Pacific, you know, really love that island vibe. And I think that's moved into places like New Zealand, because there's a lot of Polynesian influence there. And for Solomons, there was even a young girl, Rosie, from Solomon Islands, who did a cover of Adele's Hello when Adele first released that song. And I think one of the Black American artists came across that and did a tweet, and it just went viral. And that song's had, you know, over 30 or 40 million views on YouTube, the reggae cover, that is. So I think there's a real talent and knack for that island reggae R&B vibe in the Pacific. And from the Melanesian side, yeah, PNG, Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, Fiji.
Now, turning to you again, Alan, you've spent quite a bit of time in Australia during your life. What are some of the lessons you've learned while in Australia that you think could be applied to the music scene in PNG? You know, more looking more about the industry or supporting artists, those sorts of big structural things.
Yeah, I'm a strong believer in luck and also making your own luck. And I believe that Australia is the lucky country. You know, you can come here with nothing and make a name for yourself, because all of the things that you need, the environment is conducive to, you know, individuals being able to grow. You know, I think if you have the right attitude, if you're willing to get out there and give it a go, as they say here in Australia. And so I was fortunate enough to be sent down to boarding school at a young age. And when I got exposed to you know, electronic music and music at large. I really just soaked it in. And I played for bands, you know, when I was in university. I did a Bachelor of Design, majoring in graphic design. And while I was working in a design agency, I was playing for a band, a local pub band. And when the band broke up, I decided to just take on something where I could sort of concentrate on working on my own skill set. And so I found this thing called DJing, which initially started off as a very lonely sort of, you know, lonely form of artistic expression, where you're just sort of going through crates of music yourself in record stores and trying to find the next biggest track. And that whole scene for me blew up because the timing was very good. There was a place called the Fortitude Valley back in the early 2000s. And that was a little bit underground. The valley was seen as a bit of a seedy joint, a lot of drugs, prostitutes. And it was seen, you know, sort of seen as like a hard sort of place. A lot of my friends went to the city, which was very, you know, commercial R&B pop sort of scene. But I stuck in the valley because a lot of my university friends who were in the arts, they loved going to the valley and experimenting with, you know, that whole club culture, as you would call it. So I was introduced to that sort of in my early working life. And so while I held a 9-to-5, I started doing club circuit as well in Brisbane. And I think by the time I got to 2005, 2006, I was doing a 5-club residency while I was working, still holding my 9-to-5 design job as well.
There's definitely a lot of evidence there about your passion and your energy and your commitment to the industry and to making music, even while you have all of these competing priorities. You're currently in Melbourne studying blockchain-enabled business at RMIT. Tell us a bit about that, and where do you see the potential for emerging technologies to support the music industry in PNG?
Yeah, I think like most people, I sort of came across blockchain, you know, pretty randomly through Bitcoin. I think most people have heard what Bitcoin is. And that's usually what I say to when people ask, oh, what are you doing? You know, blockchain. Oh, what's that? I say, oh, Bitcoin. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, yeah, Bitcoin. And I came across Bitcoin in 2016, 2017 while I was in Australia. And I, at the time, it had crashed. It had come tumbling down. It was up about $25,000-$26,000 for one Bitcoin, and it came crashing down to around $4,000 or $5,000 for one, which I thought at the time was ridiculously expensive. And I thought, oh, that's, you know, too much. And then a couple of years later, it hits an all-time high of $65,000 for one Bitcoin. And so I looked more into the technology, the underlying technology, which is blockchain. And when I read the white paper and I read a lot of books on blockchain, and I began to dig a bit deeper, I went down what you'd call a rabbit hole. And the more I dug, the deeper I went. And, you know, you sort of go off into this other world. Obviously, now it's a lot more popular, I guess you would say, because it's been around for a while. It's sort of tested. You know, I mean, it's still young, but it's sort of, you know, it's tested, you know, that's in terms of like, I guess we're coming on to 10 years. And I thought I at that point, I was ready to hang up my headphones. And I decided that I would sort of move more into the media realm because I'd gotten married and I'd had kids, and the whole touring and gigging was becoming a little bit too much. So I decided to stop DJing and sort of focus my efforts a little bit more on music production. But I've been used to sort of pivoting based on things that I find interesting, and I've always followed my gut instinct. And I just believed that at the time around 2017, more so, that that blockchain was a thing. It was actually a thing. It wasn't just a fad. A lot of people were saying that Bitcoin was a bubble. It was going to come and go. But the more I looked into the underlying technology, I went all in. So around 2018, I decided that I was going to study blockchain, but that didn't happen until 2022. And it took me a good, 2 to 3 years to really do more research and start investing money into it. And around, I think last year is when the NFTs really blew up. And it's when NFTs sort of came about that I thought this may be something that can really help our local artists, smart contracts and how artists, how we distribute royalties and license music fairly and sort of cut out the middleman. And also looking at how we can help our local artists through things like blockchain technology and even newer technologies like NFT.
Okay, so there's a lot of potential there to connect artists with avenues to protect their livelihoods and to get more out of the music that they produce so that they're able to produce more, in a sustainable way. So very interesting to hear about that, and would love to track the issue over time once you've finished your studies. I'd also love to hear more, Alan, about the Central Music Association and also about your streaming project and how you're looking at tackling IP and copyright issues. So quite a few things there to unpack. I'll leave it with you and walk us through that.
Yeah, so the Central Music Association is an interesting one, and it sort of came about in 2019, when I went back to Papua New Guinea in 2019, there were some talks that were being held by different bodies about copyright and IP in the creative industries in PNG. And what we found is that there wasn't a music body, like, for example, in Australia, you have APRA, the Australasian Performing Rights Association. And you even have like smaller sort of state organizations like Q Music, Music Northern Territory. And so we didn't have these bodies set up, and yet artists wanted a home. We needed a home. We needed a place where all artists sort of could come together and talk about music and share in their concerns and interests. And so we decided to form the Central Music Association, Central being a province in Papua New Guinea. And the two provinces that have a lot of long history of music is the East New Britain province and the Central province. And about 60% of music up to the early 2000s, 60% of all music in the country was produced by those two provinces, namely recorded music, that is. And so it was sort of, it just seemed like a natural fit for us to sort of kick off. A lot of attempts have been made to set up a national body, but because PNG is so diverse, we have over 800 different languages. We have over 1,000 different tribes, and we only have 8 million people. So for a country that's so small, we're very diverse. And so it was quite tough for a national body didn't seem to work. And so when we did the provincial one, it seemed very natural because we all speak the same language. We all have same similar cultural background. And I don't think that the timing wasn't quite right for a national body yet. So we set up CMA in 2019, 2020, and we were lucky enough to get funding from the Australian government to basically, we put forward a project to do a digital footprint for the Central Music Association. So what's a digital footprint? Well, basically, we wanted to socially map the province, where the artists come from within the province, and what languages are they singing in? What languages are they recording in? And then basically compiling a database of songs, MP3 files, MP4 files, lyrics, and sort of connecting that all in a digital sense. And so we got funding from the Australian government, and that allowed for us to set up a digital footprint. And that was a real blessing, because I think that was the beginning of that sort of solidified for a lot of our local artists that, okay, this is the thing. You know, we're actually moving. We were beginning to get traction. We were going from region to region within the province and going out to the rural areas to basically touch base with our local artists. And it was very humbling coming from a place where I'm used to sort of being in the city and traveling to other countries. It was very humbling to really get down to the grassroots. And I think that's where the work needed to be done, is on that grassroots level. And we were lucky enough that last year I got invited on behalf of CMA to travel with our ministry for culture. They were writing a policy on culture and in 2023 to 2033. And me as the interim president for CMA, we traveled with that particular ministry to different parts of the country to sort of help do research and set up their policy framework. And funnily enough, they didn't have much of a, they didn't have any allowance for the digital realm, which was so, when I read through the policy, I was just, I was almost mortified that they hadn't done this. So I was thankful that I was there and I was able to make the suggestion to add in digital format for the creative arts and music and film and TV. And they took that on board, and that's now been included in the policy for our creative industries in PNG.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the music streaming service that you're intending to launch?
Sure. So we had a three-phase approach for CMA. Phase one was to build a website. Phase two was to build a database. Phase three was to build a commercial application. Now, when we got funding from the Australian government, we got funding for phase one and two, which was the website and database. But when we got quotes on doing phase three, the music application, it was quite expensive, around, you know, starting at $250,000 Australian. But I didn't realize how expensive it was going to be. So we parked that to the side. And just another coincidental I would call it a blessing, was that there was a company, an Australian company, that was ready to come into the PNG music industry, and they had already built an app. They were just looking for content and somebody to partner with. And so we had built the Central Music Association. We were legitimized. We were registered with IPA and IRC, which is the Internal Revenue Commission. We'd already gotten legs with a government-funded project. So they just saw that we were a natural fit for them. And it was a match made in heaven, because we had the content and they had the technology. So we signed an MOU with Moby Media, and they're actually based here in Melbourne. And at the end of 2021, we registered MJAMS PNG. So we now have the music platform registered, the technology is up and running, and we're now onboarding our local artists for this music streaming app. And it will be the first local music application in PNG. And basically, it's for local artists. As your music streams, you get paid directly, earning royalties directly to the artist.
That sounds like a fantastic project. Let's zoom out a little bit, and maybe we can explore how can music be a vehicle for youth empowerment in PNG. So thinking there, either, you know, as an avenue of expression, but also perhaps the youth as consumers of music. What can they learn? How can it shape their thinking about opportunities for the future and growing up in PNG today? So, you know, just trying to capture there that Papua New Guinea has a lot of young people. Most people in Papua New Guinea are young people, are youth, you know, and music is such a strong part of youth culture. So how does it engage with youth culture, and what are some of the positives there?
Papua New Guinea as a whole is where everything we do incorporates music culturally, traditionally. It's a part of you know, a person from the moment you're born to you know, when you attend funerals, marriages, when someone's out gardening or fishing, or it's just a natural part of music is an extension of Papua New Guineans. I think the thing that evolves more is and the age of technology has really made this more evident, is that our young people are really engaged in, you know, I think apps like TikTok sort of maybe have personified this a little bit more with music and dance. And so one of the things that I think there's a bit of a disparity is in our leaders, political leaders, and even, you know, so like in the business realm, there's not much investment in the creative industries. That creative industries is still very far behind. Having said that, the interest is there with the young people. And I think we just need to harness that interest and marry government, you know, government policy, government framework with things like encouraging innovation and technology and, you know, encouraging the creative sector. I think one thing that you maybe have to understand is that PNG is, you know, we're very blessed in terms of natural resource. We've got a lot of oil, gas, gold. You know, we used to have one of the biggest copper mines previously. And because we're so blessed in natural resource, fisheries, timber, I guess there was no real need to ever look at any other industry in the past. But I think our leaders are beginning to realize that you're not always, you know, at some point the natural resource is going to dry up. And also we're learning globally that it's not, you know, creating big holes in the ground is not good for our environment. And people are becoming more conscious of global warming and trying to do better for the environment at large. So I think there's a natural movement towards looking at other industries. And one of those happens to be the creative industries now, where, you know, our leaders are beginning to see, wow, we have a lot more interest in entrepreneurship. There's a lot of interest in innovation in fashion, in that tech space, you know, innovative innovative agriculture, and I think that they're starting to realize that there's other avenues that PNG can sort of launch itself into in the Pacific and the world at large, with things like the creative industries, and I think music is at the forefront of that.
So thinking about the creative industry then, how can we use music to build stronger connections between PNG and Australia?
In PNG, I think 60 or 70% of the land in PNG is still owned by Papua New Guineans. And we call them indigenous landowner. I think the term indigenous in Australia is more specific to Aboriginals or Torres Strait Islanders. And the same, I guess you could say, for Maoris in New Zealand. And I believe that there is at a very root level, I think there is a strong indigenous connection with PNG and Australia. And I think that goes back to the days of Sun Guma. It's one of our top, they were the first local band to travel internationally back in the 70s or 80s. And around the time that music scene was blowing up, there was a band called Yotu Yindi here in Australia. And actually, Sun Guma did an opening for Yotu Yindi in the 80s, and they were so impressed by that band that they actually they snatched a couple of the key musicians there and asked them to go on the rest of the tour with them. And so there was just this natural connection in sort of world music at that time, in those early days. And I think that that's still very relevant in this day and age from a cultural point of view. Also, I believe that Australia has, you know, amazing structure. Australia is very accountable. And one of the things that I really appreciate about Australia is, you know, how regulated things are. And obviously, you know, there's good and bad when it comes to regulation, but all in all, I think it's an important thing to have. And unfortunately, our music industry is not very regulated in PNG. And I think we have a lot to learn, you know, from countries like Australia, which, you know, that's our closest neighbor. We have a lot of history. I'm a Papua, and my grandfather is what you call a Fuzzy Wuzzy, and he fought in the war in Kokoda. And there's a long history there, you know, with Australia and Papua New Guinea and even New Zealand with the Anzac War. So I think, you know, there's a lot of connections on many fronts, culturally, in the wartime, and more so in this modern age. You know, PNG is basically stuck in the middle of the Pacific Island, which seems to be this territory that's sort of, it's such a big territory because it's named mainly ocean. You know, you have China fighting for space here in the Pacific. You have the US is very aware of what China is doing in our region. And so you have Australia and the US also trying to ensure that there is, you know, equal footing in the Pacific. And meanwhile, here you have PNG trying to find its way in this modern time. And so I think there is a lot more room for partnership and growth in relationship with PNG and Australia, especially in the creative realm. I feel like we can learn a lot from Australia, and I feel like Australia can also learn a lot from PNG because we are so diverse in culture and tradition. You know, as they say, unity through diversity, I think is now becoming a common term or a common theme in this global world that we live in.
You've painted a picture there for us that captures a historical connection, a deep cultural connection and affinity, and a complex geopolitical region. If you were a young artist growing up today in PNG and wondering how to make a start in the music industry, what advice would you have for that person?
If I was a young artist starting out right now, man, I would be so lucky, because when we started out, it was pretty tough. Technology was just coming through. We didn't really know what we could do with it. You know, young people are so blessed with things like YouTube, you know, where you can basically, you know, I mean, I'm in university now, and I'm doing my second degree, but, you know, it's so expensive to pay for university, you know, to go to university. And there are so many people that basically, they call it the you know, YouTube university, where you basically jump online and you teach yourself what you can on YouTube, and that's really the I would just encourage our young people to use what's there. The technology is there. You know, it's very easy to get sort of stuck in your own little bubble, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, appreciate where you come from. Tell the story that you can tell from your own little village, from your own island, because I believe that the world is looking for those unique stories now. It's not like back in the day where you were trying to move things according to what the interest of masses was. I think we now live in a time where even a story of an island boy or a village boy up in the highlands is, you know, that uniqueness is more interesting to the world at large. And I think our young people should embrace that, and also embrace technology as well and carve out your own path.
Well, that's very uplifting advice. Look, we're coming to a close, Alan, and I only have one more question for you. We'd love to hear more about what are your plans for the future?
Well, I'm back in school, so I'm studying again. If you had told me I'd be studying, 5 years ago, I probably would have laughed. But I believe wholeheartedly in what it is that I'm studying, and I also feel very privileged that I'm able to study, and I'm able to be in a place, a city like Melbourne, at any university like RMIT. I just feel so blessed, and I know I'm not going to take that for granted, but I'm also excited at the fact of being in a creative hub like Melbourne. Globally, it's just such an interesting creative place, a melting pot. And so I'm unsure at this point where my career or life will take me, but I'm very open to where life leads, and I'm very thankful that I'm able to learn, and I'm going to learn as much as I can. I think learning never stops, and I think the moment that I stop learning, that's probably I'll be on my way out if I get to that point. So who knows whether it's going to be a continuation of this NFT space or blockchain space, or if that evolves into artificial intelligence and Web3 and the metaverse. We're yet to see, but I'm looking forward to any one of those.
Alan, thank you for drawing us a picture of a very exciting future indeed. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I want to thank you once again. Thank you very much for taking the time to walk us through a little bit about how music is such an important part of PNG identity and culture, and for telling us a bit more about your life and your connection with music. So thank you very much, Alan Kadea.
Thank you so much, Mihai. Thank you.
You've been listening to the AusPNG Network Leadership Podcast Series. Podcast from the Lowy Institute, with production support from Darcy Milne and Josh Godding. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode.